Afterward, Robin asked me to come by his apartment in New York to discuss the issue. He began telling me about it in character as the genie. He was a troubled but lovable man, and he'd often take refuge in the voice of some character or other. I said, "Talk to me as you, Robin," and he finally did, very quietly. We spoke for 2 hours, and I told him I'd fix it. I called Eisner, who tried the usual, "Your client had a contract, and he got paid." I told him Robin didn't want any more money, but that he deserved a significant gesture of recognition for what he'd done for Disney. The movie would gross more than $500 million. Michael finally agreed to give Robin a showpiece painting, such as a Picasso. I went and found a suitable Picasso at the Pace Gallery and told Disney to send Arnie Glimcher a check for $4 million. I knew that, expensive as the painting was, it was worth much more. At that point, Eisner declared that the painting would remain a Disney property, but that he'd lend it to Robin. I got mad and said if I didn't have a client as nice as Robin, I'd demand $15 million. Robin got his Picasso. At Eisner's surprise 40th birthday party, and it was a genuine surprise because I threw it on his 41st birthday, the producer Larry Gordon gave a toast to Eisner that, in passing, noted that I was always telling the studios how to run their business. The truth is, I had learned over the years that creative people were much better at taking candid criticism than business people. A Bob Town would thank me for my notes on his scripts, but execs got intimidated and thought I was telling them I could run their businesses better than they could. I wasn't telling them that exactly, but there were certainly times that I thought that. My self-confidence alarmed Eisner in some fundamental way. He was surprisingly threatened by potential competitors. His wife, Jane, and I repeatedly tried to turn him around on his longtime deputy, Jeffrey Katzenberg, whom he was always accusing of imaginary crimes and planning to fire. There were real crimes to accuse Jeffrey of. He was dull to the point of robotic, but Michael's main problem with him was that Katzenberg was capable and insanely hard-working, and therefore Michael's obvious successor. Part of me loved Michael Eisner like a brother. He could be so charming and funny, and part of me thought he was even more paranoid and manipulative than I was. I watched him eviscerate numerous people over the years, but I always thought there were three people in Michael's inner circle he'd never hurt. His childhood friend, John Angelo, Larry Gordon, and me. When Michael had quadruple bypass surgery in 1994, I was at his side in the hospital round the clock, driven to try to fix him up. He was in terrible shape, depressed, shaky, and slow. One day, to galvanize him and get his mind back on business, I mentioned a big idea I'd had for a way to break the studio network cable stranglehold on content distribution. The phone companies had plugs in everybody's walls. Why not use them to bring content to the home? I told Michael I'd gone to Ivan Seidenberg, the 9X president, who had an eye for next-gen technology. Together we envisioned an interactive service that would combine telephony, TV, and the internet, all through existing phone wires. We'd have an array of news and sports and entertainment with original programming by CAA clients. We had signed up not only 9X but also Bell Atlantic and Pactel and brought in CBS's Howard Stringer as our CEO and Sandy Grushow from Fox to assist him, planning to rapidly establish a national footprint. It was a huge deal. CAA would get $50 million across the next 5 years and own a quarter of the enterprise, and we believed we were going to completely disrupt the nascent cable industry. As it turned out, tele-TV was a great idea that was too far ahead of the technology. The cable triple play was 5 years off, and Verizon Fios more than a decade away. After I left his hospital room, Michael immediately called Ivan Seidenberg to try to get him to leave me for a similar deal with Disney. When he struck out with Ivan, he called his deputies and had them sign up Americast and GTE to compete with us. Furious, I confronted him, but he danced away from what he'd done, as usual, and he was so sick, I didn't have the heart to press him. MGM was in real disarray. At a CAA movie department meeting in the late 80s, one of our agents announced that he'd gotten an offer for Sean Connery for The Russia House, a spy picture based on the John le Carré novel. Another agent piped up, I have an offer for Michael Douglas for the same role. Two MGM executives had gotten their signals crossed. the kind of screw-up that could prompt a star to shop for a new agency. We told both actors what had happened and got lucky. Michael passed after reading the script, and Sean took the part. As MGM's debt mounted, Kirk Kerkorian sold it to Ted Turner. Ted ran into financing problems and sold most of it back to Kirk, who threw it on the market once again. By then, the studio was releasing fewer than 10 films a year. In November 1990, Kerkorian sold MGM at a nice profit to a mystery man. Neither Hollywood nor Wall Street knew much about Giancarlo Peretti, who'd financed his $1.3 billion offer through Crédit Lyonnais, the largest bank in France. Peretti bought an $8 million house in Beverly Hills and made all the parties and premieres. I gave him a wide berth, instinctively distrusting the kinds of guys I called pop-ups, outsiders who popped up in our business looking for fun, glamour, or unrealistic profits. Over lunch one day, Sean Connery remarked, "Damnedest thing about this guy Peretti. I met him when he was a maitre d' at the Savoy Hotel in London. I can't figure out where he came up with $1 billion. There may have been less to Peretti's fortune and his home-stunning art than met the eye. After he gave Terry Semel a lovely small Picasso, Terry was ecstatic. Then he had it appraised and discovered it was a forgery. Picassos in Hollywood are worth either much more or much less than you think. MGM's savior lost $500 million in 2 years before defaulting on his loan. In 1992, after prosecutors on two continents brought charges of securities fraud, Crédit Lyonnais foreclosed, and the end for MGM loomed. I saw an opportunity for CAA to replace MGM as the seventh major. 4 out of 5 CAA packages turned a strong profit at the box office, and we'd been de facto executive producers for years. Why not take the next step and furnish the financing, too? My model was based in part on First Artists, a company put together in 1969 by Freddie Fields that featured Dustin Hoffman, Barbara Streisand, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, and Sidney Poitier, each of whom agreed to produce 3 films. They had hits like A Star Is Born and Uptown Saturday Night, but the consortium slowly fell apart because Fields made the criminal mistake of not requiring the founders to make their big films for First Artists. Streisand did a dud called Up the Sandbox for First Artists the same year she made the hit What's Up Doc for Warner Brothers. I was also inspired by the Directors Company, which my old mentor Tony Fantozzi had put together at William Morris, a group founded around Peter Bogdanovich, Francis Ford Coppola, and William Friedkin, that had a hit with Paper Moon, a critical success with The Conversation, and then it, too, slowly fell apart. I wanted to assemble a group of our top directors, people like Spielberg, Zemeckis, Levinson, Scorsese, Pollock, Oliver Stone, and Ron Howard. The directors would pledge 75% of their projects to the cause. They'd get their normal deal, but 10% of their fees would go into a reserve fund to hedge against failure. After running the idea by 5 of the directors, all of whom said they were really interested, I asked Frank Rothman, the former MGM chairman and top litigator, to look into the jugular question. Could an agency produce movies? Under our guild agreements, CAA could own up to 10% of a production or distribution company, but I had in mind a more intricate deal where a studio would be bought by a consortium but controlled by CAA. We'd partner with a bank, a private equity fund, and the pool of our top filmmakers. Frank's white paper doused my enthusiasm. He concluded that CAA would probably get sued and that we'd have to take on and take down at least 2 of the 3 guilds. Though they were less than full-fledged labor unions and eminently breakable, we had close relationships with those people. The heads of the Directors Guild and Writers Guild were CAA clients, and Bill Haber and I had helped settle the writers' strike in 1988. The members counted on us in their skirmishes with the studios and networks. I reluctantly concluded that going to war with our clients was an unwinnable battle, even if we won. In March 1993, I flew to New York to meet François Gilles, the multilingual managing director of Crédit Lyonnais, which now reluctantly owned MGM. After a leisurely conversation about the south of France and our mutual love of the region's cuisine, we turned to the studio. Gilles had met with 8 leading investment banks, all offered the same advice. To deal with its $3.2 billion in troubled entertainment assets, the bank should break up MGM, lay off its 2,400 employees, and sell what assets were left, mainly the Lion logo and sister studio United Artists' 1,100 title film library. MGM's library already belonged to Ted Turner, and Lorimar already owned the famous studio lot. On paper, that course seemed prudent, as the studio was burning through $1 million a day. Total liquidation could shave the bank's losses to $900 million. I said, I have a different point of view. I think you should put another $150 million into MGM so it can start distributing movies again. And why would that be best? Because your bank wants to open branches in New York and do more business in America. It would be terrible public relations to fire more than 1,000 Americans and plow the MGM name underground for good. After letting that point sink in, I said, I believe I can get you most of your money back, if not all of it. CAA could jumpstart the studio with a few movie packages, which would buy the French time to revive UA's tentpole franchises, Rocky, The Pink Panther, James Bond. New production would boost the older title's value. When Crédit Lyonnais eventually sold MGM, as required by the feds, it would get a much better price. Gilles said, no one else agrees with you. I stayed impassive, but my heart leaped. In any multiplayer contest, you want to be the outlier. I told Gilles, everyone you've met with is in the business of selling assets, but I'm in the business of building assets, and I think you are too. You've given me a lot to think about, he said. A day or two later, Gilles called to say that he took my points about his bank's image. MGM was cherished in France, where people adored Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz. The bigger risk, Gilles agreed, was to sack all those people and settle for 40 cents on the dollar. The bank wanted to enlist CAA as its sole consultant. On the heels of our work with Columbia and Universal, our work with Crédit Lyonnais would give CAA an inside track with half the buyers in town. Yet reactions from our colleagues seemed very positive. I took calls from a dozen outside agents who were eager to see MGM saved and United Artists revived. Even rival studios felt protective of the house of Marcus Lowe and Louis B. Mayer. Then came the backlash. In a story with ICM's fingerprints all over it, the New York Times' Bernie Weinraub raised a potential conflict. How could CAA consult with a studio's owner while putting clients up for jobs in that studio's movies? ICM's chairman, Jeff Berg, publicly demanded that we divulge the details of our deal with Crédit Lyonnais, calling it an unholy alliance. He even went to the U.S. Department of Justice to ask for an antitrust investigation, which never happened. I understood why Jeff took his shot. ICM had ruled the business in the late 70s and early 80s, but now they were a distant second. We had signed Michael Mann, one of Jeff's most important clients, and taken Meryl Streep, Glenn Close, and Mike Nichols from Sam Cohn. ICM still had Mel Gibson, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Julia Roberts, Richard Gere, and Eddie Murphy, but that was about it. All save Murphy were represented by Ed LaMotto, who was one of the people who'd called to thank me for MGM. He knew our plan meant more work for his clients. Berg's next play was to front for the billionaire Bill Koch, who was toying with buying a movie studio. Believing that a premature offer could force the French to sell too low, we gave our 70 movie agents their marching orders. Tell everyone you meet this week and on every call you make that the Koch story is nonsense and that Crédit Lyonnais is not selling MGM. In the days before the internet, a unified body like CAA could shape what Hollywood was thinking. Koch helped us out with a bungled public reference to French Lyonnais and a press release on Metro Golden Mayer. He shelved his bid within the month. The entertainment press called Jeff Berg Hollywood's second biggest agent, but he couldn't have cracked CAA's top five. Ron Meyer had a far stronger client list. So did Bill Haber, Jack Rapke, Paula Wagner, Lee Gabler, and Rick Nasita, the co-head of our movie department. Not long before I met with Francois Gilles, Rick told me that Jeff had asked to see him about the ICM president's job. I advised Rick to take the meeting, if only to find out what ICM had in the fire. Just listen, I told him. Pretend you're a client. Let him pitch you. Jeff sold Rick hard, saying he intended to go on a hiring spree. The standard bullshit when you're trying to poach a top agent. He said he wanted Rick so badly that he'd pay him more than he made himself, around $1 million a year. It had to be deflating when Rick said, I'd have to take a huge pay cut. He was making more than 3 times Jeff's offer. Of course, Jeff had a fair point about our work on MGM. CAA was, by design, a confluence of conflicts. Whenever CAA packaged a movie or a TV show, we represented a producer who wanted the tightest possible budget, as well as the artists who deserved the market rate. The week after we paved the way for Les Moonves to go to CBS, we were pitching our clients' pilots to him. The conflicts were all out in the open, known, factored in. That's how Hollywood worked. But I assured the guilds we'd keep hands off MGM's creative management and off any privileged information. It made no difference to us what non-CAA clients were making. In any case, we were the ones setting the market. The controversy ended there. In 1991, when Paramount fired Frank Mancuso from the top job and stonewalled on the $20 million plus it owed him, depending on how you did the accounting, we had returned one of his many favors. I went to Martin Davis at Gulf and Western, Paramount's parent company, and reminded him that Frank was well-liked in the community, and especially so at our agency. Marty paid Frank $15 million. Frank was available, highly capable, and well-disposed to us. My original plan was to bring in Frank under MGM's current chairman, Alan Ladd Jr., to get United Artists up and running. Then Francois Gilles called. We've removed Laddie, he said. How do you want to restructure? By the next day, we'd assembled an alternate hierarchy. Let's bring Frank in as chairman, I told Francois. I'd found someone else for United Artists, John Calley, the former Warner production head. 12 years earlier, John had called it quits at 50 and moved to his 35-room house on Fisher's Island in Long Island Sound. When we'd met up recently in New York at Mike Nichols' office, he told me, I know your time is valuable, so let me lay it out for you. I'm sleeping 12 hours a day. I've read every book that's out there. If I stay retired, I'm going to die. I want to go back to work. I instantly thought of the sad retirement of Ted Ashley, John's old boss, and I said, let me see what I can do. Frank was 60, and John was 62. They knew how to rapidly restock the studio's pipelines. We completed the team with CAA's Michael Marcus as MGM president under Frank. Mike was a first-rate film agent and packager, as good as anyone available, and I didn't care what our critics might think. Crédit Lyonnais went beyond my proposal to more than double MGM's credit line and remove a massive debt from the studio's balance sheet. It was money well spent. By 1994, the studio was out of danger. 2 years later, Kirk Kerkorian paid Crédit Lyonnais $1.3 billion to once again become the studio's owner, more than double MGM's breakup price. Frank Mancuso thrived at MGM until he retired in 1999. John Calley used United Artists as a springboard to a valedictory run as chairman of Sony Pictures, where he had hits such as Jerry Maguire and Men in Black. In 2005, a partnership headed by Sony bought MGM in a deal worth $5 billion. To this day, the studio provides jobs for working actors, writers, and directors. 6 months or so after Crédit Lyonnais engaged us, we tallied MGM's movies in development. One agency had far and away the most clients working there, 3 times as many as CAA. It was ICM. Chapter 15. Always Coca-Cola. I met Coca-Cola's top executives at the Allen & Company conference shortly before they acquired Columbia Pictures in 1982. Don Keough, a gregarious man who'd been at Coke since 1950, was the ideal number two for Roberto Goizueta, a suave, shrewd chemical engineer. While Don shared Roberto's sweeping vision, he also sweated the details. On a trip we shared to Texas, he found a payphone to report an out-of-place Coke sign in the airport. They functioned like co-CEOs, expanding a massive Fortune 50 company built on sugar and water, and they were fun to be around. Coke had owned the studio for about 5 minutes when Don came to the boisterous premiere for Gandhi, a CAA package on its way to 8 Oscars. Don threw his arm around me and said, "My God, the movie business is fun. And it's so easy." Uh-huh. 2 years later, with Ghostbusters in post-production at Columbia, we urged Don to put the movie's logo on Coke cans for the release. But he and his team in Atlanta were extraordinarily protective of their brand. Only after Ghostbusters became a hit did Coke begin using its logo, too late for much benefit to either party. We did get them a free ad, though. Years before product placement came into vogue, Ivan Reitman took my advice and put a Coke in Sigourney Weaver's haunted refrigerator. It never hurt to ingratiate a director with the people who paid the bills. At the Allen Retreat in 1990, a year after Coke sold Columbia to Sony, I stopped by Herb's condo and found him on his back porch having coffee with Roberto and Don. The talk was of Pepsi's New Generation ad campaign, which had Roberto worried. I was sitting there quietly sipping my Diet Coke when Don asked me, "What would you do?" "I've never thought about it," I said, "but as someone who watches a lot of television, I think you guys are getting clobbered in the image market." It wasn't an offhand remark. Market consulting struck me as a natural step for CAA, as we already had an extraordinarily accurate bead on mass culture. We received concrete feedback, ratings, grosses, album sales, on a daily basis, and we knew well ahead of the crowd not only what the buyers were looking for, but what Steven Spielberg and Norman Lear and Michael Crichton were doing next. Yet, as much as I liked the Coke guys and their product, I hadn't considered working with them until they sold Columbia and removed any possible conflict. Not long after the Allen retreat, Don called and said, "We want to fly you out to talk about the company." 2 days after that, he met me in the lobby of their Twin Tower headquarters in Atlanta and walked me into Roberto's office, where it was always 65 degrees. At 9 a.m. sharp, they poured a round of Coke Classic into paper cups, and for the next 3 hours we discussed how Coke could stave off Pepsi. Coke's nemesis was Phil Dusenberry, the chairman of BBDO. Phil had reshaped the cola wars in the 1960s when he helped conceive the Pepsi Generation, advertising's first lifestyle campaign, and reshaped them again in the 1980s with his "The Choice of a New Generation" TV ads. His spots with Ray Charles saying, "You've got the right one, baby," were memorable and effective. By casting Pepsi as the drink of the young, Phil cast Coke as the drink of the olds. Coke still ruled the international market, but its North American margins were slipping, and Pepsi was catching up in supermarkets. 5 years from now, Roberto told me, I think we could get beat. Coke's advertising had stalled. Its latest slogan, "Can't beat the real thing," didn't move people. Like Roberto, I knew it was a lot easier for a brand to lose prestige than to regain it. When I was a kid, my father drove a Chevy but yearned for a Cadillac. By the time I bought him one, Cadillac had been eclipsed by Mercedes and BMW, never to regain its luster. But it wouldn't do for me to come on with a hard sell. I mirrored Roberto and Don's behavior, which was foreign to Hollywood, courtly, southern, restrained. Don't hype me, don't sell me, just tell me. When I confided my plan to expand CAA into marketing, Roberto said, "What do you need from us to get started?" I said that first I needed time to think about my approach. Detecting Herb Allen's hand behind the meeting, I flew straight to New York before he left the office for his 6 o'clock dinner. "Look," he said, "you've got something, and they need something, and they're asking, does it fit? My suggestion is, figure that out, and fast." I called Don. "Here's what we propose. We'll bring a group of our executives for an all-day meeting with your division heads. We want to know their issues on the ground, what they think of their competition, what they like about your ads, and what they don't. We want to hear it all." We put together a team of in-house experts in movies, television, music, and books, and we combed every Coca-Cola print ad and commercial since McCann Erickson got the account in 1955. 2 weeks later, we met in Atlanta with 10 division heads, and then we broke into small groups for no-holds-barred discussion. The meetings lasted 12 hours, the best one-day education I ever had. Weary but exhilarated, I returned to L.A., and told my partners we were moving ahead. Haber was all for it, but Ron didn't say much. I knew he was already imagining our artist calling him to complain. What the hell are these guys doing? They should be working for me. It was a legitimate concern, and there was this, too. By venturing into an arena where we had zero experience, we could be setting ourselves up for a big, fat public failure. But I thought Ron was missing the bigger picture. My epiphany came a few days later in Brentwood, after I put the kids to bed. I was in my home office, checking TV Guide to see what was on, and it hit me. The same Coke commercials aired on all of these shows. Traditional ad agencies cooked up 7 or 8 spots per client per year, and each one played morning till night. One sight, one sound, one sell. But the TV audience was now as fragmented as the rest of American society. Seinfeld or Letterman aficionados weren't the same people who followed daytime soaps or the NBA playoffs. Friday night sitcoms skewed younger than Saturday Night Live and much younger than ABC's Sunday Night Movie. Why not trade the shotgun for a rifle? Why not customize ads for each group? My first big idea for Coke was to make different spots for 60 Minutes and The Simpsons. Our challenge was to restore Coke's cachet with young people, but first we needed to get and hold their attention. Infrared TV remotes had invaded the American household. Viewers clicked to a new channel when ads came on or went to the kitchen or the bathroom. My kids ran off to another room to play, so Coke's commercials had to tell stories the way movies did, only much faster. They needed to entertain. Advertising wasn't subatomic physics. Make commercials fun to watch, and viewers would embrace them. From there, I worked back inductively. Ad campaigns had 3 essential components: raw ideas, creative types to develop them, and technicians to produce the finished spots. The first 2 were CAA's stock and trade, and the 3rd could be hired by the job. While outsourcing was frowned upon by ad execs, who raked in extra revenue by keeping everything in-house, film studios often outsourced their trailers. Why couldn't Coke do the same? Ads were expensive because Madison Avenue bankrolled its own commercial houses and then marked up each fee by as much as 18%. CAA could undercut them by going straight to the talent. Our directors worked on big, draining movie projects. Many of them would jump at the chance to make a miniature film with total freedom for a 6-figure paycheck. I grabbed a legal tablet and jotted down our manifesto. Holiday relay race, more commercials, demographically stimulated, no one sight, one sound, new music, new graphics, hire creative people. The next morning I called Don and Roberto and said I had something, and you're either going to love it or hate it. My guess is you'll love it, but it's high risk, high reward. Inoculation, pure and simple. Then I flew to Atlanta and in Roberto's icebox of an office, made my pitch for CAA to produce 2 dozen Coke commercials for what McCann charged for 7 or 8. My thinking was to roll out a few spots at a time, each set tied to a season or holiday. Think of it as a relay race, I said. The summer was about heat, the beach, refreshment. In September, a back-to-school feel. Then family gatherings for Thanksgiving, snow and holidays up to Christmas, hope and resolutions for New Year's, love and companionship at Valentine's Day, family themes again for Easter. Second, each spot would be tailored to a demographic niche on the network schedules. Third, we'd blend people from movies and advertising to create a new kind of commercial, a mini-movie. Fourth, Coke would pay CAA a consultancy fee of $1 million a month, plus expenses and outsourcing costs, but we wouldn't charge supervisory markups on other people's work. If we got the account, they'd pay us a fair price for the ads we did. Fifth, we'd set our ground rules. That meant no market research, because we trusted our taste more than we trusted focus groups. Non-traditional agencies like Chiat Day, which downplayed research as they devised daring campaigns like 1984 for Apple, were rising fast. Once the commercials were finished, Coke could say yes or no, but they couldn't ask for changes, and we expected Roberto and Don to attend our presentation along with Doug Ivester, who was next in line for Don's job. I liked dealing with executives who could say yes. Every intervening layer added another potential no. "I don't want your research guys interpreting our spots for you," I said. Roberto said, "How many CAA people would you be using?" I said 5 or 6 tops, which must have sounded like science fiction because McCann Erickson had more than 300 staffers on Coca-Cola. Michael, Don said, I think we're ready to shake some trees around here. He sounded sincere, but I knew it wouldn't be that simple. Hiring CAA would destabilize Coke's long relationship with McCann and its parent company, the Interpublic Group, and like everyone at Coke, Don had close relationships at McCann. He was particularly close to his drinking buddy John Bergen, the McCann vice chairman, who'd come up with Coca-Cola's last strong slogan, Coke is it, in 1982. Around Labor Day, Coke hired Peter Seeley and made him its first global marketing director. A former marketing chief at Columbia Pictures, Peter was a pro who knew that his job depended on a fresh approach to the company's $600 million annual ad spend. He was our champion from day one, but despite Peter's efforts and my weekly calls to nudge things along, Don and Roberta waffled for more than a year. Then, in the fall of 1991, in a statement the press called the September Surprise, Coke disclosed that it had hired CAA as Worldwide Media and Communications Consultants. As Peter told the New York Times, American culture, broadly defined, has become the culture worldwide. We are in a global village, and CAA represents the single greatest source in understanding that culture. I flew to Atlanta for Roberto's benediction, which was disappointingly vague. We need a new direction in our advertising, he told me. And I'm glad we're discussing what that might be. At big companies, nobody wants to own a new idea before it's clear whether or not it's a stroke of genius. After someone complained to the Screen Actors Guild about our apparent conflict as agents and producers, we told the New York Times on background that CAA would not be directly involved in producing commercials. The issue with SAG was moot because we'd never planned to use our clients in front of the camera. In those days, any big actor doing commercials was presumed to be washed up. Expectations have since relaxed considerably, but at the time, putting Sean Connery or Jessica Lange into a Coke ad would have been like pimping them on the street. Coke's announcement made us comfortable enough to hire a creative director. We chose Shelley Hochran, a studio marketing exec whom we'd seen do a great job with Stand By Me, even though it had no stars, and with Reds, even though Warren Beatty refused to do publicity. As an outsider doing advertising, she hadn't internalized rules from the Don Draper era, and Peter Seeley, her old boss at Columbia, regarded her like a daughter. To keep the peace for the time being, Peter announced a tripartite alliance. Coke would define the mission, CAA would generate the ideas, and McCann Erickson would produce the commercials. It was baloney, and Peter knew it. We weren't going forward without total creative control. McCann later leaked a story to Adweek that we had broken the pact and were actively recruiting writers, directors, and producers to create the Coke ads independently. True, except there was no broken agreement. Peter pre-approved everything we did. McCann wasn't giving up its best account without a fight. They poached Gordon Bowen from Ogilvy & Mather and told him to put us in our place, but Gordon got buried in the firm's infighting. When he asked if he and John Bergen could work out of our Beverly Hills office a few days a week, I hesitated, leery of roosters in the hen house. Bill Haber said, invite them in. Why take the chance? Their company will never let it happen. So I invited them in, even prepared a nice-sized office for them, and Bill's hunch turned out to be dead on. John Dooner, McCann's president, vetoed Gordon's request, fearing we'd steal their secret sauce. It never crossed his mind that they might learn anything from us. In 1992, as Don Keough neared retirement, Phil Dusenberry turned the screw by backing Ray Charles with the Uh-Huh Girls, a sensation in their own right. Pepsi sales and supermarkets drew within 2 percentage points of Coke. Patience, as I've noted, is not one of my virtues. I told Herb Allen, intending that he pass it along, that we really want to do this campaign, but if Coke can't commit, we'll try our hand with someone else. Within days, I heard from Don. Were we up for a shootout with McCann Erickson? A shootout was two or more agencies doing pitched battle in the same room. I didn't like the sound of it. While I was game for a fair fight against McCann, I worried this was a face-saving put-up job and that politics would cost us the account. I said, "Don, this is an elective for us. You came to me. Now you want us to compete for what I thought we already had." "Look," he said, "it's different at a public company. You guys are in the driver's seat, but there are some twists and turns along the road. Come here in October and show us your stuff." Stifling my frustration, I told him we'd be there. To support Shelley, we hired the former number two creative guy at Shiat Day, Len Fink, as her partner. Len had a deft feel for both urban and middle America. We met several times to assuage his doubts about our long-term plans, and then we offered him a 50% raise. We later tripled both his and Shelley's salaries into seven figures. Bill Haber jumped into the project with both feet. We added a mailroom trainee named Jonathan Shredder and sent him to an art bookstore with $3,000. The five of us convened in our creative room to rip out hundreds of pictures, from Monet and Magritte to Lichtenstein and Thomas Hart Benton, and tack them up for inspiration. Within a few weeks, we had 300 raw concepts. Half made it to the storyboard stage, where Len and Shelley drew each scene in sequence. Eventually, we narrowed it to the 24 spots we'd present to Coke. Though at times we felt puny compared to McCann, we had some advantages, too. No bureaucracy to zap our riskier ideas, no protocols to smother us. We didn't want safe ads. We wanted great ads. 3 months before the shootout, we reconnoitered with the enemy in Georgia to watch McCann submit slogans. Gordon Bowen suggested A Spark of Life, which Don and Peter had previously rejected. Astoundingly, John Bergen trashed the idea and proposed Always Coca-Cola instead. McCann's top creative people were knifing each other in public. When I saw that Don liked Always, I said, "That's great, let's use it." Don said, "You really think it's great? It's fantastic." We bent over backward to seem friendly toward McCann. We had to keep Interpublic on board to implement Coke's global media buys. I was agnostic about Always as long as we governed everything else. We cared only about the visual's entertainment value. The slogan was an add-on. I called Quincy Jones and asked him for the best unknown songwriter he knew. He gave me a twofer, the team of John Nettlesby and Terry Coffey. They composed a two-bar theme and mixed it with a range of beats, country and western, middle of the road, urban, Latin, classical. To score points with Don, we ended each spot with our Always Coca-Cola theme song. The October shootout was our title fight. McCann owned the legacy relationship, so we couldn't just beat them on points. We had to knock them out. I bought Armani suits for Shelley and Len, who'd be presenting. We packed white shirts and bright ties for a uniform look, like Hoffman and Cruz taking on the casinos in Rain Man. The day before the event, breaking CAA's no-daytime fly rule, I scheduled a noon departure on Coke's Gulfstream 4. When we boarded in Van Nuys, Peter Seeley was on the plane to greet us. He so wanted us to win that he spent the flight prepping our team about Coke's internal politics. We checked into the Atlanta Ritz-Carlton and were chauffeured to Coca-Cola for a dress rehearsal. Rather than practice word for word, I sailed through my remarks with lots of yada 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 so as not to get stale. Shelley and Len checked the setup for their graphics and skimmed through bits of the commercials. We left for dinner at the hotel and were in bed by 10 o'clock. The next morning, Haber and I went to the gym. The five of us met for breakfast and a final run-through before changing into our freshly pressed suits. We looked and felt unbeatable. We arrived 15 minutes early. Up front were two tables for the combatants and a third for the Coke executives, with several rows of seats in back. Haber and I sat at CAA's table with Shelley and Len standing to our right. Roberto, Don, Peter, and Doug Ivester took their stations. 11 a.m. came and went with no sign of McCann. 10 minutes later, two dozen disheveled ad people filed in. Next to our lean, mean team, they were corporate bloat personified. A mistake. After flying commercial out of JFK at 7 o'clock that morning, they were hungry, tired, wrinkled, and generally out of sorts. Not springing for a night's lodging in Atlanta. Another mistake. Peter Seeley asked who wanted to start. Before I could jump in, John Bergen said, "Let's do a coin toss." They won, and I was dying because I desperately wanted to go first. Then Bergen opted to go second, the by-the-book move to make the last impression. A final mistake. We opened with a single slide, a calendar strip with Coke bottle images to mark the major holidays. I explained our relay race concept and stressed that our spots were designed to entertain. While I played to the Coke executives and referred to them by name, I occasionally turned to bore my gaze into McCann's rank and file, the dazed and disoriented group at the rear. No harm in trying to intimidate them. In closing, I said, "Pretend you're sitting in front of your television set. You've had a rough day at work or with the kids. Your mind's floating. You're watching TV for the reason we all watch it, for passive entertainment. There's nothing you need to do but sit there and have fun. Enjoy." Shelley and Len took it from there. Using their props, living color storyboards, rip-o-matic videos, animation shuffle books, they acted out the commercials like a rapid-fire play. Some came with sound effects. One had Len panting like a dog on all fours. Others were introduced with an A-list name attached. Dick Donner, the director of Superman and Lethal Weapon, will be doing this commercial. It was a blizzard of ideas pitched Hollywood style with motion and emotion. Each spot closed with our tape player cueing an always Coca-Cola beat. I was prepared to jump in if needed, but their delivery was flawless. Don and Roberto were laughing at each joke and swaying to the always theme. When the Latin beat came on, Roberto looked ready to glide across the floor. He ordered 200 copies of the tape for friends and relatives in Florida and Havana. At McCann's table, Bergen passed a note to the guy beside him. I caught the scrawled message. "We're screwed." We saved our best for last. Vividly drawn polar bears, swigging Cokes as they watched the Aurora Borealis as if they were at a drive-in movie. When we needed a mascot for the Christmas season, it was Shelley who'd said, "What's warmer or furrier or friendlier than a polar bear?" In real life, these animals are stone-cold killers, but curled up on a snowfield, taking in the northern lights, they seemed positively lovable. Inspired by the bright primary colors in Bauhaus Stairway, the Roy Lichtenstein and CAA's Atrium, our polar bear vignettes became an animation landmark. By the time Bill Haber gave a crisp summation, our momentum was an avalanche. I had the last word. Looking squarely at Roberto and Don, I said, "Give us 6 months, and we'll give Pepsi a run for their money. We can take them out. What do you have to lose?" I sat down. John Bergen later told Business Week that my presentation was so charming that I almost started applauding. Two young McCann creatives shuffled forward like death row convicts, dead men walking. They made their first pitch, a stiff recitation off handheld notes. They began a second one, and then they crumbled. They broke off in the middle and sat down. Bergen said, "We're done," and they all filed out. We had literally driven them from the field. The world's marquee ad account belonged to CAA. Coke bought every one of our 24 ideas. We asked Rob Reiner to direct a spot for the daytime serial set. He tracked a couple's romance from childhood to their 50th anniversary with a Coke and two straws punctuating each time jump. For the soundtrack, we wanted the Beatles song When I'm 64, a real nostalgia trigger for baby boomers like me. We used CAA's clout to get the president of EMI to sell us the rights, albeit at a record price. Other directors did little films for primetime, including a Tuscany shoot by Joshua Brand and John Falsey, the creators of Northern Exposure and Saint Elsewhere. A Shelley Hochran special, it featured a sexy, sweaty glassblower crafting a Coke-shaped bottle while a sultry young woman watches through a doorway, clearly turned on. The sensuality and lack of dialogue were perfect for Europe. By making commercials that could travel overseas, we saved Coke millions in production costs. The polar bear animation was outsourced to Rhythm and Hues, an L.A. visual effects studio that did wondrous things. They went on to win Academy Awards for Babe and The Golden Compass. We bounced their first drawings back, demanding more realism. Blacker eyes, wetter noses, furrier fur. Not a single execution went late or over budget, and contrary to Ron Meyer's fears, our clients loved the whole thing. Two-thirds of the commercials were shot by our directors. Timeline was devised by Len Fink on an Apple IIe computer. In 1886, Coca-Cola was invented in Atlanta, Georgia, ushering in the modern period of peace, harmony, tranquility, fire, and rocks. It was cool and funny and dirt cheap. conceived to run on Saturday Night Live. We billed Coke $35,500, exactly what it had cost us. They sent us $355,000. When we called the guy who cut their checks, he said, "It was Friday, we were closing, and we were sure you'd made a mistake." No Coke commercial in memory, he said. It cost less than seven figures. In February 1993, days before our first spots hit the air, I asked Roberto to debut all 24 for the media in New York. Doubtful at first, he decided to trust in my enthusiasm. To avoid stealing our client's thunder, I skipped the event. While I felt great about our work, I didn't expect Coca-Cola to entirely share my confidence. I was stunned when I heard that Roberto ran the premiere himself. The reporters were wowed. They watched lush stop-motion animation based on Thomas Hart Benton's Heartland, with farmers plowing golden wheat fields to a score out of Aaron Copland. They saw a Dick Donner spaceship comedy with a big payoff. To catch an alien imposter, the captain quizzes his crew about the world's most popular soft drink. We had a takeoff on René Magritte's surrealist Golconda, with Coke bottles dropping from the sky, and a haunting urban night scene out of Edward Hopper. From the erotic glassblower to an all-percussion spot with the Blue Man Group, our ads were wildly eclectic. But the final image for each commercial, backed by the Always jingle, was Coke's button, a red bottle cap with the century-old trademark in white cursive. Peter Seeley told us the polar bears clinched it, and the press conference became a love fest. Journalists like to be entertained, too. The New York Times called our campaign as extraordinary for who created and produced it as for its unexpected freshness, breadth, and playfulness. Almost all the commercials are infused with a cleverness, an assertiveness, and an edgy yet fun-filled feeling absent from Coca-Cola advertising since the new Coke fiasco in 1985. Time wrote, "To the ad industry's dismay, nearly all the new commercials introduced last week were produced by CAA. Even worse, they are terrific." A few weeks later, Phil Dusenberry walked up to me at a New York cocktail party and said, "I don't know where you came from, but my hat's off to you. We've had to reassess everything we're doing." Shortly after our first spots aired, Roberto Goizueta paid a visit to CAA. He strolled through the office passing out custom Hermes ties with a polar bear print, a victory lap. Peter Seeley sent me a check for $10 million for the ads. Not bad, but I returned the check with a post-it note attached. "Pete, let's discuss this." We did, and then I called Don and Robert. I was friendly but unrelenting, and Pete finally sent me a new check for $31 million. They thought it was too much. I still think it was too little. I should have insisted on a royalty for the polar bears, which they've used ever since. In the second quarter of 1994, Coke logged a 6% gain in U.S. case sales and a 12% increase in profits. By then, our second campaign was airing, and even Advertising Age tipped its hat. The new pool of 30 spots is the best Coke advertising and maybe the best soft drink advertising in decades. CAA had demonstrated that no one had a monopoly on good ideas. We paved a two-way street between Hollywood and Madison Avenue. In years to come, commercial directors like Michael Bay and David Fincher would migrate easily to feature films, and all sorts of people, design studios, digital shops, integrated marketing firms, would grab pieces of the advertising pie. Many borrowed the ingredients we pioneered with Coke, from a seasonal relay race to demographic tailoring to dialogue-free commercials for worldwide use. It wasn't long before commercials, most notably for the Super Bowl, were expected to entertain. In the months that followed, we were offered the accounts of Burger King and of GM's Oldsmobile and Buick lines. We didn't think we could do much with Burger King, and I told General Motors we'd only be interested if we could do all of their advertising, not just their two shakiest brands. I put it more politely than that, of course. We were also offered Kodak, but we knew from our work with Sony that digital photography was just around the corner and that Kodak was basically doomed. The overarching issue, and the reason I slow-walked a lot of these inquiries, was that I had a plan with Teddy Forstman to buy J. Walter Thompson, the huge multinational ad agency. That was my exit strategy. We'd give the Young Turks day-to-day responsibility for CAA, Ron would be its CEO, and I'd run the conglomerate, building it out to acquire other media properties. I'd floated the idea with the Guild, telling them we were interested in an ad agency, and their reaction was violent. You can't produce ads. We thought that getting our clients ad work would help strengthen the Guilds, but they didn't see it that way. Once again, being an agent had put me at the intersection of exciting possibilities and prevented me from pursuing them. In retrospect, I should have just gone ahead with the J. Walter Thompson plan as a minority shareholder. CAA would take 49%, Teddy 51%, and I'd ease into the majority ownership later. It's exactly the move Ari Emanuel and Patrick Whitesell made recently at William Morris Endeavor. They're now producing ads. Of course, times have changed. The Guilds, now eager to have work for their clients, didn't fight WME. At the turn of the 21st century, Advertising Age celebrated the top 100 people in the modern history of the field. A number of my heroes made the list. Leo Burnett, Dan Wyden and David Kennedy, Jay Shiat, Phil Dusenberry. Number 87 was a surprise. Michael Ovitz. In September 1991, he rocked the advertising world by signing Coca-Cola. That partnership set off bi-coastal shockwaves and embarrassed longtime Coca-Cola agency McCann Erickson, especially after the soft drink giant began airing CAA's commercials featuring high-tech animated polar bears and a catchy Always jingle. Such a la carte options still affect agency-client relationships. We came into advertising and went out of it with a bang. Chapter 16. I'm not afraid of you. In the early 1990s, the slumping U.S. economy created a slew of buying opportunities. With Matsushita sitting on mounds of cash, MCA could have bought a network, cable companies, a gaming company, and film libraries, and made itself the industry leader. Instead, it did nothing. Lou Wasserman and Sid Sheinberg flatly snubbed the Japanese. You need to reach out to them, I kept telling Sid. Take them out for drinks, go to a restaurant, and try their favorite foods. Go to Osaka and learn about their culture. Their arms are open. They only need to understand what you want to do. Lou hosted one dinner in 5 years, and he and Sid treated the scribes like invisible men. The Americans took the money. Lou cleared $352 million in preferred stock from the deal, Sid $92 million, but kept running MCA like they owned the place. Matsushita's $6 billion bought it only contempt. Finally, Lou moved to buy Virgin Records, which would have jumped MCA to the top of the music business. I warned Sid that his owners might be put off by Virgin's name and that he needed to help them understand what a British anchor could do for them in Europe. Sid never bothered to explain their thinking, and Matsushita scuttled the deal. It was the beginning of the end. My father used to tell me stories about the Seagram Company's patriarch, Samuel Bronfman, the Canadian bootlegger who built a billion-dollar dynasty. He was a seat-of-the-pants entrepreneur like the old studio chiefs. I could tell how much my dad respected him. In 1985, my father turned 65. I'd moved my parents to a house near us in Brentwood, but my father had no outside interests, no hobbies. Without work, he'd fade away. Edgar Bronfman Jr., Sam's grandson, was the company's CEO. I made an appointment to see Edgar, whom I'd never met, in the Seagram building on Park Avenue. After the usual pleasantries, I said, "I'd like to ask a favor, and I'll owe you." "What's the favor?" "My father, David Ovitz, has worked for you for 45 years, and he's about to be forced to retire. I'd like you to keep him on. I'll reimburse you whatever you're paying him, including taxes, so it won't cost you anything. I just want to be sure he doesn't lose his job." Edgar said, "I know your father's been with us since Chicago." He'd clearly prepped for the meeting, which I took as a sign of respect. "He's a wonderful guy, and everyone likes him. I'll keep him on, and you don't have to pay me anything." My dad worked for Seagram until he was nearly 80 and never knew why an exception had been made. Edgar, the third-generation Bronfman, wanted to recast the family legacy. Seagram's capital was tied up in DuPont, the high-dividend chemical giant that brought in two-thirds of the company's earnings. It was safe and secure, but Edgar wanted action. He began calling me during the breaks in DuPont board meetings, saying, "Get me out of here." By 1992, he was asking me how he could buy an entertainment company. I met with his father, Edgar Bronfman Sr., the Seagram chairman, who'd once had his own fling with show business. In the late 1960s, he briefly owned a controlling interest in MGM. And then I gave a presentation to Seagram's board in which I said their best option was Time Warner, the conglomerate run by Steve Ross. With the exception of a theme park, Time Warner checked every box on my grid. It owned a leading cable operation, the top music company, Warner Brothers Records, and more than 100 magazine titles, including Time, Fortune, and Sports Illustrated. But Steve's advanced prostate cancer made the company's future precarious, as his second-in-command, Jerry Levin, was an unknown quantity. In M&A, instability is red meat. I connected Edgar to Herb Allen, who said, "Time Warner is the one." Edgar heard the same from Felix Rohatyn and John Weinberg, the ex-Goldman Sachs senior partner on the Bronfman's board. Edgar believed he had his father's blessing, but he wasn't sure about his risk-averse uncle, Charles Bronfman. When I met the Seagram's directors, it was Charles who'd asked the sharpest questions, but I thought he'd defer to his older brother when the time came. We had agreed that any move should be tabled while Steve Ross was alive. I had another thought. Why not go to Steve and work something out? Today's friendly investment could be tomorrow's power play. That September, I reached Steve at his beach home in East Hampton. "I want to come see you," I said. "I've got an idea that might help." "Come on out," he said. "I'll send the chopper for you." I cleared my visit with Steve's doctor and nurse and called his wife, Courtney, to coordinate. The helicopter met me in Midtown Manhattan and landed 40 minutes later at East Hampton Airport. When Steve came to his door, it was hard not to gasp. The strapping guy with thick white hair was a gaunt shell. It broke my heart to see him. We went into the den where Steve whipped out his omnipresent legal pad. The nurse granted me 30 minutes, so I got to the point. "Steve, I'm here because Seagram is willing to put $6 billion cash into your company right now to be used at your discretion. They want 2 board seats. They'll sign a standstill for 3 years, so they won't be moving in to take it over." Steve came alive. He scribbled notes on his pad, then threw out ideas about what he might do with the money. Pay down debt? Take on more debt? Buy? Sell? He was as sharp as ever. My 30 minutes stretched to 3 hours. The nurse came in and said, "Mr. Ross, I'm sorry, but we cannot allow this to go on. You need to come with me right now." After another 10 minutes, she physically pulled Steve from the room. On his way out, he told me to meet with his deal guy, Ed Abboudi. "Sure," I said, "but I have the feeling Jerry Levin will view this as a threat." "I'm still running the company," Steve said, "and this is what I want to do." Ed Abboudi had no formal title. He was the emperor's trusted counselor, which made him formidable. As he wasn't subject to the usual chain of command, it was hard to leverage him. When I met Ed at the Palace Hotel, I could sense that I had no traction. I inferred that he had already aligned himself with Levin, who knew that Steve was terminal. When I met with Levin not long after, my fears were confirmed. Some people were fooled by Jerry's turtlenecks and meek demeanor, but he was a bare-knuckled infighter who had risen to COO by outmaneuvering his competitors. When I told Jerry what the Bronfmans were thinking, I hit a wall. "We'll take the money," he said, "but no board seats." I said, "You know, Jerry, the Bronfmans want to be in this business. They love your company, and you're pushing them into a difficult position." My hint of a hostile play didn't perturb him. Steve no longer had the juice to lock things down. Our deal was dead. With Herb's and Felix's approval, Edgar and I went to Seagram's board with our backup plan to slowly amass Time Warner's stock using Allen & Company as the purchasing agent. The plan went into effect after Steve Ross died that December. By May 1993, Seagram owned more than 5% of the company. 8 months later, it owned more than 11%. Herb Allen was skillfully amassing stock without attracting undue attention. The idea was to plateau at 15% before suddenly jumping to 20%. At that point, Edgar could swing Time Warner's board and change top management at his pleasure. But before Seagram could get there, Levin pushed his board to adopt a poison pill. Any buyer moving past 15% would trigger a flood of newly issued shares, diluting the buyer's stake. Seagram had so much cash, we could easily have bought the necessary extra shares and gotten the poison pill revoked, but Edgar, somewhat inexplicably, pulled the plug on the plan.